Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
I am joined once again by Professor James Hudnut Boimler, the Ann Potter Wilson Distinguished Professor of American Religious History at Vanderbilt University, where he also served as Dean of the Divinity School from 2000 until 2013. Dr. Hudnut Boimler appeared on our show last year talking about his book, In Pursuit of the Almighty's Dollar, A History of Money and American Protestantism. Since that time, he has released yet another book entitled Strangers and Friends at the Welcome Table, Contemporary Christianities in the American South. That will be the topic of our discussion today. This new work is in addition to his several other books, including Looking for God in the Suburbs, The Religion of the American Dream and Its Critics, 1945-65, and Generous Saints, Congregations, Rethinking Money, and Ethics. If you haven't figured it out by now, Jim is an expert in the historiography of religion in the American South, as well as 19th and 20th century American religious history. He also specializes in the use of non-textual evidence in studying religion, and also examines topics in religion and philanthropy. Prior to coming to Vanderbilt in 2000, he was the dean of the faculty at Columbia Theological Seminary, a program associate for the Lilly Endowment, and director of the undergraduate program in public and international affairs at Princeton University. Check out all of Jim's great books over at our website, and we'll have other links to cool things that we talk about on our program as well. Jim, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
This new book, Strangers and Friends at the Welcome Table, is both an interesting read for its intellectual insights into religion in the now South, as you call it, but it also seems like a really fun book. It seems fun to write. It reads both like the standard academic book explaining social trends, but there's kind of a road trip quality to this. How did this book come about, and were you seeking that kind of vibe for it?
Yes, I wanted to make a contribution in academic terms to the literature, to be sure, but because the answers to the questions I asked couldn't be found entirely in libraries, I was asking now kinds of questions. Is this still true about religion in the South? I hit the road in the tradition of James Agee and Zora Neale Hurston. And the evidence of a road book is constantly, or is consequently, more narrative than footnote-like. If you as a reader think it was fun, I got it right. People love to talk about why they do their religion the way they do, if you ask nicely, at least in the South.
Yeah, it has the vibe of that too, the friendliness, wanting to talk, because if you look at the cover, and we'll have a picture of the cover over at our website, everybody's sitting around what looks like a wooden picnic table, and their hands are folded and engaged, and there's a number of different people of different races there. So it's a really kind of a welcoming book that deals with some interesting and controversial topics as well too, in strange, or I shouldn't say in surprising and nuanced ways. Let me ask you about this whole issue of the now South. You use that term throughout the book, and it seems to be important. I would guess that it's a play on terms for what was referred to as the New South starting back in the 1870s. So what is the now South in comparison to the New South? And if you even want to throw in there the Old South.
Sure. Well, New South, properly speaking, referred to the South post 1877, as you may know, depicted by Atlanta newspaperman Henry Grady, who was saying to people, "We're over all that now. We're not the Old South. We're not looking back to Terra, but we're open for business. You can come on the train to Atlanta, establish your establish your businesses, and we love each other now, etc. But by now, South, I really mean to draw a line even after the civil rights South, and to note a lacuna on my shelves full of Southern religious history books that very few people had written as far into the late 20th century and 21st century, in part because the civil rights era is so interesting. But there have been changes going on around me in the last 20 plus years that I wanted to document, write about, and explore. And to say that the now South is its own period.
When you talk about the South, too, and you talk about in terms of the now South as a period from roughly the last half century, maybe focusing on the last 20, 30 years or so, but also there's a geographic component to this. What are the parameters of the South? What are we talking about here?
Well, I define it in the book religiously and geographically. So it's a religio-geographic definition. It is, to be sure, the states of the historic Confederacy minus Texas, and minus Texas because, as Texans will remind you, they are their own thing. It's also religious in the sense of being the places where Baptists are the majority in their states, and most counties for that matter, except in coastal Mississippi and parts places like New Orleans, where Catholics have the lead position. So geographically, think Virginia minus Nova, or Northern Virginia, which has become absorbed into metropolitan D.C., culturally speaking, and Florida below I-4, which is the capital of Latin America and snowbirds from New York. But if you put all that together, there is a remarkable cultural resonance across the area. And you probably also have to factor in, as I do, Kentucky, West Virginia, even the southern rim of the Appalachian rim of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois.
Yeah,
just the southern parts.
Mm-hmm. Talking about
where people talk southern.
Yeah. Talking about the western border there, you mentioned southern Illinois. Do you get into Arkansas? And actually, I just had saw an interesting debate with some folks whether or not Oklahoma was considered the South. So where are the western boundaries of all of this?
So Arkansas, definitely so. There are parts of southern culture that apply to Oklahoma. Oklahoma is also related to Texas. And is sometimes called part of a southern crossroads, and because of the, but I left it out of the book. You got to draw a line somewhere when you do one of these road trip oriented books.
Speaking of that road trip, and you covered a kind of a big broad South or a big broad picture here of the South. You drove around over the course of, I guess, about 10 years. This book has been about 10 years or so in the making. Did you hit all these different places, or are there some areas that you tended to focus on a little bit more than others?
I actually I hit all of the states that are in the book. I didn't do any field work. I just traveled through Arkansas and did some work by web research on that. And I should say, for people interested in research on religion in the contemporary era, it's amazing how much living religious congregations and agencies and what have you put up of their activities on the internet today. So that sometimes I'd visit on a Sunday or a weekday and then get to see several more services back home in my office.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see this on Facebook as well. I get up early on Sunday morning, and even before we go off to church, I'm on Facebook, and you know, get something from the East Coast popping up on Facebook Live. Here's the sermon from, you know, South Carolina or something like that. It's pretty amazing what's out there.
Yeah, so we don't have all the newspaper coverage of religion that you have for the 19th century and early 20th century, but wow, what a documentary record of the now we have, if we want to exploit it.
So let's get into exploiting all this knowledge and look at your book more specifically. Your book is divided into three sections, two of which I want to focus on today. And those two sections are Southern Traditions and the New Religious Innovations. The third section of the book, which is sandwiched between those two, is called Responding to Disasters. And might want to leave that for readers because it's an interesting look at Hurricane Katrina and the Mississippi flooding and how religious congregations responded to that. But we want to kind of look at these bookends of your book, the Southern Traditions and the New Religious Innovations, because it talks about how Christianity persisted in the South for a while, and then how it's being transformed now, and it makes it very, very interesting. So let's go ahead and start with the section called Rock of Ages Cleft for Me, Southern Traditions Revised. Why that title, and what does this entire section of the book seek to accomplish?
Well, Southerners now and for ages have been convinced that they're practicing the old-time religion, even if there's a little bit of new time innovation in their old time religion. And God in the referent hymn is the Rock of Ages, there forever and always and there for you personally. So all of these first four chapters are about how Southern perennial practices that have actually changed a bit in the here and now of recent history in interesting ways, are evidence of how even the most traditional subjects that we might find in the literature of Southern religious history have taken on a new life in the 21st century.
Now, one of the things that you note is that there's a stereotype of Southern Christianity that kind of relates to this Old South Christianity or the old time religion. And if I'm correct, you're from Michigan originally?
Yeah.
And so you have the vantage point of living in the South now, but having looked at this from the North down southward, tell us a little bit about the image most Northerners might have of this monolithic religious South.
Well, so I open up the book talking about coming down to Appalachia every summer with my folks to my grandparents, and realizing we weren't in Detroit anymore. And you come down US 23 and you get to where the accents are so thick that you have to ask your great uncle to repeat what he said three times, and then you don't want to answer. I've had those cultural experiences and in with church all my life because of where my father was from. But there are different Souths in the South, and I would say I also had a different experience professionally as a person in the Presbyterian Church who during reunion had to get used to different church cultures, North and South, where kinship mattered a whole lot more. For just one, you know, do I know you? Can I trust you? Did you go to school with somebody I went to school with? So I can verify your bona fides. I say in the book that if everyone had been a Southern church person, Facebook would have never gotten off the ground.
Hmm. Explain that. What do you mean by that?
Well, because we would have already known everybody's business and who they were. There'd be no need. We'd just ask the person we know about the person we don't know, but they know.
Relationships are very important in the South, as you mentioned, in kinship. In one of the first chapters that you have in this section called The Rock of Ages Cleft for Me is related to the relationship between people in terms of hospitality and food. And that's a really interesting one. And it also plays into the whole aspect of the book in the title of The Welcoming Table, of The Welcome Table. Tell us a little bit about this relationship between hospitality, food, and Christianity in the South.
So food is important in the South, I think, as John Edgerton helped me to see, in part because the memory of scarcity, of not having enough, is both a historical memory, a long historical memory, from Civil War on through the Depression, that is in living memory, and in some places it's in, you know, actual daily experience, like in the Mississippi Delta, where the poverty rates and food insecurity is still unbelievably high. So food is one way of expressing love. You give to your neighbors what is scarce or what is made with your own hands. It's also a way to show, you know, when somebody dies or has a baby, you go over and you bring the food yourself. You don't consume it with them, but you sit for a while, almost like the practice of sitting Shiva in Judaism. It's a way of co-suffering. Food is important. People also call themselves fairly freely Matthew 25 Christians, by which they want to do the things that Jesus told them was important in Matthew 25. Feed the hungry, visit those who are in prison, house the homeless, and so on. And that leads to forms of hospitality, even though the civil society is one in which, we still jail a lot of people, we nevertheless have prison ministries to visit people in prison. So there are all kinds of contradictions in this, Christian society. And as you may know, the South is so Christian that there is no other religion in any one of the southern states that is more than 0.6% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Speaking in terms of this hospitality, and as you mentioned, you did a road trip, you actually interacted with people, you're sitting with people. It's a very ethnographic study where you're immersed in that. Do you have any good stories of this kind of welcoming culture, something that stands out in your mind that you just go, wow, I remember this vividly, being in this person's home or after church in the foyer or something?
Oftentimes, we would go to a church and we'd be in a place where, let's just say it wasn't my kind of church. I'm a Presbyterian. And I would get, I'd always identify myself, and nevertheless be, greeted with sort of, extravagant welcome. And at one point it was a Church of God in Christ Church. And I was only one of two white people in this, you know, 1,500 member church that morning. So often in terms of extravagant hospitality, it came to me when I would be visiting churches. I was always very forthcoming in terms of who I was, why I was there, I was just visiting and learning about their particular church, and I was coming from Nashville. I was a professor, but I visited a Church of God in Christ Church, and somebody had gone to my seminary, so they divinity school, so they knew who I was, and they insisted on putting me up with all the other pastors in this black Church of Christ church. And there I was, you know, singing the praise choruses and doing everything else. And it was pretty wonderful. And that happened, you know, other times. And it was the only time it was ever awkward was at the Prosperity Gospel Church in Georgia, where someone was out in the narthex was trying to see if I might join her pyramid scheme of direct marketing.
The hospitality food aspect can get ramped up into hyperdrive sometimes, as you observe, and it manifests itself in terms of a kind of a social activism. Discuss what you found about this.
So this isn't just a Southern Christian thing. Moses Maimonides said that there were levels of charity, and I think others of us have internalized that to the point where finding the least of these, whether they ask for help or not, is a measure of our piety. So you internalize the hospitality thing, you say, we should do that, and in this first chapter, I have examples of refuge ministries that only want to really help, but they only want to help the truly repentant. And if somebody won't deal with their addiction and turn their life over to Christ, they kick them out after 3 days, and they can come back in 3 months. And there are others, Manna House in Memphis, where they are so extraordinarily Christ-like that I just sit back in awe saying, you know, where do you get those internal resources? But there's a story I tell about the city fathers, the council, deciding they needed to really criminalize being mentally ill because the panhandling and all this other sort of thing had gotten bad for business and tourism in the central business district, and they'd ordered the police to pick up people. And the police started disobeying and bringing some of these people who were badly wounded in their heads to Manna House. And Pete Gaskey, one of the co-founders, said, why are you doing this? This is against what you've been told to do. And one of the police officers said, yeah, but I go to church on Sundays, and I have to stand for my actions before a bigger authority than the city fathers. It's really quite remarkable. And Pete also said, you know, this is a place where the Bible is a living document, where people argue in terms of the Bible and aphorisms for it. That they take different evidence for the Bible for different sides of a civic argument. But it's unlike the Midwest, where both he and I originally came from.
Explore that a little bit more. How different than the Midwest? Is the Midwest much more reserved, and do you just kind of keep everything quiet and the like?
While the Midwest is still a very religious culture, it's a mixed religious culture. There are Catholics and Protestants, and you would state things probably in more reserved, neutral terms. Here, since everybody, black and white, descends out of an evangelical tradition or a Pentecostal tradition, one way or another, except for the Episcopalians, people know their Bible and reinforce it in daily speech. That may erode through the 21st century as nuns begin to grow as a social factor in the South. But for now, it's part of the internal thought process of Southerners.
Talking about other differences with the Midwest and the passionate Christianity of the South, there's oftentimes a stereotype about Pentecostalism, and one of your chapters in the first section of the book touches upon the issue of snake handling, because I guess it appeared recently on a reality TV show, which I was unaware of, and then also it was featured on National Public Radio. Pentecostalism is an interesting feature of the South because it's both an export and an import into the region, as you note. So what is going on with Pentecostalism and snake handling?
So snake handling, to be clear for your listeners, is practiced by perhaps only 1,000 people in the region in less than 40 particular churches, but it gets a lot of attention. And I kept getting asked, as I told people I was doing a book on Southern religion, oh, are you going to be talking about snake handling? And I didn't know the reason for this until I got a call from a reporter who was following a case in eastern Tennessee of a preacher who'd gone a little too public about his practices. And had gotten arrested for violating wildlife laws for having venomous snakes without a license. And I was asked to comment on, you know, why the last chapter in Mark 16 didn't apply to everyone. And all Christians, all Bible-believing folks in the South, and we know they're Bible-believing because they tell us they are. Why doesn't everyone, the other 78 million people in the South, handle snakes? I said, that's a darn good question. I think the real story in Pentecostalism, which is still maybe 5-6% in terms of actual church membership of Southerners, is how much the belief that the Spirit of God is available to you to heal, to change events, to help one through daily life, how much that has seeped into other parts of Christianity in a way that in 1900 would have been unimaginable. So the Pentecostals have influenced other religions, particularly in the South, and particularly black churches, so that they're so strong now that we talk about Bapticostal churches.
What does a Bapticostal church look like? I mean, I'm kind of getting an image of what this might be, but what did you find in your travels?
Well, so a Bapticostal, one clue might be that the minister might be called bishop. Another clue might be additional offerings that are proclaimed as seeds that will be blessed, that in which, just like an old Oral Roberts kind of thing, you God doesn't want losers. God wants partners. God wants to bless you if you bless him. There's a certain kind of light prosperity preaching that goes on in a Bapticostal service. And moreover, there's, as I said before, a strong sense that the Holy Spirit is there, and it's God's Spirit is there for your good, not for ill.
I skipped over one of the chapters entitled The Religion of the Lost Cause Reloaded between these two that we talked about here. And many folks outside the South associate white Christianity with Confederate racial attitudes. And the recent shooting of the 9 African-American Christians at a Bible study at the Charleston Emmanuel AME Church seems to really kind of solidify this notion. Your chapter paints an interesting picture of what is going on here, and maybe a little bit more nuanced than some of the stereotypes might have it. So explain this whole chapter, The Religion of the Lost Cause Reloaded.
Yeah, you know, William Faulkner famously said in Requiem for a Nun that the past is never dead. It's not even past. And that's still true of the South in ways that wound, like Civil War memorialization, venerating people like Forrest, Nathan Bedford Forrest, actual people who would be war murderers, war criminals in any other war, and plantation tours that valorize the white masters and mistresses and ignore the people who made it all happen. But also, it's true in a kind of biracial shared culture of faith where people believe nearly the same things and encounter one another across the race line far more frequently than in the North. And you go to a place like Memphis, or a place like Nashville, where I live, and your doctor's office, your grocery store, is a multiracial experience, and it is true that there are wicked racist people, but there are also people who wish to connect and will connect on the basis of something shared. Like faith. So it's a very different kind of place than we have in some of our more actually segregated big cities. And the very fact that Dylann Roof was welcomed into the Bible study and prayer meeting at Mother Emmanuel stands out for me as a sign of that kind of regional Christian good faith. If the brother wants to come in, let him come in. This guy looks troubled, and then he uses it for such evil racist purposes. And you can see how wounded all of Charleston was.
Yeah, you paint a very interesting picture of that whole incident and the different aspects of it. And if I'm correct, too, the members of the AME Church actually reached out with forgiveness, which I surprised a lot of people, right? It surprised a lot of people outside the South is that how could you show forgiveness to somebody who does something so horrific? And what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I tried to convey what my black friends and colleagues have taught me to see, and that part of that forgiveness is something that they have been taught and teach their children as Christians. It's not a forgive and forget. It's forgive because if you don't forgive, it'll wound you. It's It's a kind of, I won't let you wound me forever and ever by giving you that power. And I also tell how some people outside black church circles saw that as a kind of racial politics of black respectability. But it has its own codes, and you know was aimed at helping the wounded community at Mother Emmanuel and related families begin to heal from this heinous act.
Your book also examines Southern religious traditions in terms of religion and politics, which is my bailiwick. The stereotype of the South is that it's a conservative, evangelical, Republican, massive red, just swamping over every part of the South, except maybe a few islands of blue here and there. But you also point out that there's a strong vein of progressive Christianity associated with civil rights in the region and a new growing trend. Tell us about this.
Well, a good bit of my professional career has been spent with progressive Southern Christians who set their moral calendars by their heroes, MLK Jr., Lillian Smith, John Lewis, Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, even the novelist John Grisham, if you read him carefully as a Southerner, is a sort of a more gifted Southern Sinclair Lewis. He's always got some social and religious axe to grind. So that there are people who are proudly Southern and especially proud that they've transcended their Southern racist neighbors. And these folks are especially to be found in our big cities, our state capitals, and college towns here in the South. And they are becoming more numerous. Yet, at the same time, the white progressives among them are periodically subjected to the disappointment, like every election cycle, of being outvoted by rural Southern Christian evangelicals. And, they get their hearts broken again and again. That's a mistake that black Southern Christians don't get sucked into. Willie Jennings and William Barber, both, when I wrote the book, both of North Carolina, were not so sanguine about the great future of the South. There are some people who have kind of never changed their hearts when it comes to we'd like to keep things the way they were. My chapter on politics and religion demonstrates we're as close as we've ever been in the South to an effective resistance to a religion of white supremacy. There really are folks in the South who talk just among us white folks that things have gone too far, and there are an increasing number of folks who find that offensive on religious grounds and are willing to step up. And it's this balance between outstate rural power in the legislatures and the big cities. You know, this is a region at war with its university towns and capitals and major cities. And again, as I said before, they'll pull out the Bible and have a "What would Jesus do?" Conversation, even on the floor of a state house or senate, that is kind of unimaginable in Albany, New York.
The discussion of religion and politics in the now South, as you call it, springboards us into a a whole host of other developing trends in this region that some of us folks outside the region might not suspect, but are really interesting, and that paints a very fascinating spiritual tapestry in the region. And the third section of your book deals with this, and it's called The Brand New Start. So let's walk through some of these interesting trends that you've identified and how it's transforming the region. Let's go ahead and start with the rise of megachurches. What is going on there?
So everyone who comes to the South from anywhere else has the instant impression upon driving around that there are a lot of churches. And that, boy, oh boy, the churches are big. And they're not mistaken. I mean, I go through and demonstrate that we are a highly churched region. I know anecdotally that a lot of southern cities call themselves a city of churches. Well, you know, not everybody can be, or they call themselves the city of churches. Not everybody can be the city of churches. But it's an easy claim to make in the South. The churches are more numerous, and big churches are more numerous. And big Baptist churches got big along with big Presbyterian, Episcopal, and Methodist churches, and AME churches way back in the early 1900s. What's different is that these mega churches, those worshiping over 2,500 on a weekend, are even more influential in the southern context. And they grew out of moving to suburban locations, moving out of the city and to a place where you could have a huge parking lot and build, you know, a room for every age group and program up like institutional churches of the late 19th and early 20th centuries did in urban places, but even more so. And the interesting thing that's happened, from my standpoint, is that they have become a kind of single standard for what a great church looks like for a lot of other churches in the South. So that if the mega churches have big old screens up front that show your Hillsong praise choruses, then a little country church that worships no more than 100 might also have two big screens up front. The churches just have screens. And the ludicrousness of it is when they show the pastor, whose head you can see just fine from anywhere in the 10 rows, on both screens, bigger than life-size, while he's preaching. You know, it's just the mega church becomes a kind of way of doing church that is a fashion and becomes a de rigueur sort of cultural expression of church.
Another major trend that's been going on that you point to as well is kind of relates to some of the mega churches which host this stuff is the issue of homeschooling. That's been a phenomenon that's exploded in the past 25 years or so. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in the homeschooling movement and religion down in the South.
Yeah, so homeschooling, sometimes when you think of homeschooling, you think of, oh, this is big in the Pacific Northwest or in Idaho or Colorado or something like that, where, you know, it might have been hard to get to school or it might have been a kind of a resistance to government. There's a dimension of that, but I want to get to the religious dimension first. And one of the things that emerges The southern difference is that homeschooled children in the South are differentially more likely to be the children of the children who went to Christian schools, that is, segregation academies, for religious reasons, read racial religion, racial reasons, at least in part, in the 1970s and 80s. And those children of the children are now, in the South, most likely to be among the homeschooled. Because what happened in those Christian academies? Well, they've become multiracial. Now, for a couple of reasons, for focus on the family type reasons, homeschooling is the parents' duty to raise your own children in a godly manner, and with this sense that the South has never had a really strong commitment to public schooling, the public schools are weak and underperforming in a lot of places, and then get branded in the Christian homeschooling subculture as government schools, not public schools, government schools. So there's a emphasis on doing well by your own children, and nurturing those tender leaves until an age of responsibility that's right around college, when they can go off to a reliable Christian college, of which there are a number down here who will recruit and love homeschooled children. Welch College and Bob Jones and others like that.
One of the other trends that's going on is the rise of Catholicism in the region. It's taking on a new dynamic down there, because we think of the South as being a bastion of Protestantism, and there are a few pockets in the past. New Orleans, as you mentioned before, are places where Catholics might be located, but Catholicism is starting to transform itself in the region, and so explain what's going on there with Catholicism.
Yeah, so in the book, I show a great Catholic home missions map from the 1930s, where they proclaimed the South no priest land, and showed how few priests there were to provide services to the very few Catholics in the interior of the South. So, along the Ohio River and along the Mississippi River and along the coast, the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast, there were some Catholics. Not a lot, but there were Catholics in places like Louisville and, of course, New Orleans and St. Louis and so forth. But in the center, not so much. So the Glen Mary Missioners made it their task to send people to the South. Two things have happened to transform the South. One, the first, and to tell the story short, is that auto companies came to the South in a big way, and priests followed them. And that's sort of transplanted Catholicism. So much, in fact, that there was this great case of people from Buffalo, New York, and in Georgia, trying to actually buy and move one of their abandoned parish churches to Georgia in the last 15 years. But the more significant one has been the influx of Roman Catholic Hispanics from Central and Latin America, Central and South America, and Mexico. And that has led to two great stories. One is the burgeoning of interior Catholicism, and the other is for if you're Catholic, and even if you're, say, white Catholic, you're much more likely to be pro-immigrant because the church says these are your people, these are your brothers and sisters, than the Protestant evangelicals are likely to be. And in Alabama, when this state government went after immigrants, it was the two bishops of Alabama, together with a Methodist bishop and an Episcopal bishop, that stood up for the immigrants and those who would help them. And so it's an interesting story of a changing South that's becoming not just Protestant anymore, and not just black and white. The old black and white binary is breaking down slowly in our time.
One of the other amazing changes taking place in the region as well, very surprising, is covered in the last chapter of your book, or the last chapter of that third section, and that deals with the issue of homosexuality. What is going on there?
Well, a wiser Southerner than me said that the difference between an eccentric and a freak is that an eccentric is somebody in your family. So that the thing that's been happening in the South with LGBT persons and religion is that folk aren't fleeing to the North or the Bay Area or staying in the closet as they once did. They're telling those whom they love and loved going to church with who they are and who else they love. It's become legal and socially acceptable to say you're gay, or that you're transgendered, feel you're in the wrong body, and that troubles the waters. Meanwhile, it's easy to preach hate against a group, and it's much, much harder not to love and show hospitality to your family members when they tell you they're gay or lesbian. So we're seeing what the Human Rights Campaign has always called the power of one. If you know one person who is in a life condition, you understand them, and we get back to the power of kinship to transform Southern culture. Now, I don't want to overstate that. A very, very small number of Southern churches, 700 plus, are LGBT friendly out of something like 56,000. But again, in the college towns, the big cities, there are choices, and congregations are making choices to be welcoming. And there are even congregations that are being established to be fully evangelical, as any Baptist or non-denominational church you can find, that are composed from the pastors and educators on down of LGBT people, some of whom I talk about and visit in the book, who are changing the face of Southern Christianity. You know, they refuse to be silenced in in being both Christian and gay.
It is indeed a very interesting read that has a lot of surprises, twists and turns, maybe reinforcing some stereotypes here, but blowing away a lot of other stereotypes. So the book is really useful in terms of that, painting a very nuanced picture of what the region has been and is becoming now. The book is Strangers and Friends at the Welcome Table, and I urge folks to pick it up because we haven't covered all aspects of it, and there's a lot of wonderful stuff in here. I want to finish off with this question, though. And I always tend to see scholarship as a journey that not only do you present your results to others, but it often happens to transform you along the way. And as noted in the early part of our discussion, this book was about 10 years or more in the making, and a lot of intellectual growth and change can occur over a decade. And you've been in the academic game for even longer than 10 years. So here's my question for you. If you were to go back and talk to a younger Jim, maybe 25, 30 years ago at the outset of your professional academic career, what would you tell the younger you about what is to come ahead?
I had been working on on the idea of doing a book on a topic of a course that I teach and have been teaching for a while. I teach a course on Jesus in modern America, and you know, just as I was getting ready to do this, within a few months, Richard Whiteman Fox's book on the topic and Stephen Prothero's book dropped. So I was casting around. So I turned to another topic, the contemporary history of religion in America, because it'd been sort of haunting me that there wasn't a book for the last week in the course, right? So one thing I'd say to myself is pay attention to the books you don't have. They're telling you something about if you're interested in something, somebody else would be. So I began the luxurious way of a post-tenured professor with the help of a graduate student, Lydia Wilski, who spent a semester, 10 hours a week, building a bibliography of everything written on religion in the South, old and new. And then I taught the literature several times with graduate and professional students. I was honing my research plan. So, Tony, it's not a plan you can pursue when you need to rebound quickly from the first book and get a tenure book out. But I tell my younger self that the glory of getting older, more secure in academia, is that you can take the time to do hard projects. Hard in the sense of time-consuming and conceptually challenging. Yeah, here's the fun dimension of being a more experienced scholar that I wish I could tell myself, my younger self, 30 years ago. It's that the 2 weeks of great readings about the colonial South that you loved, Jim, but didn't think were your thing, can take on a wonderful life of their own. You know, if you like that, you can go back to that. Our best interests and questions can fund our research long after we thought, yeah, that's over. So pay attention, I would say to myself, to the stuff you liked, make a note of it, and come back.
Always good advice, because I find myself in the exact same position now, revisiting things that I thought I had left on the side of the trail a long time ago, and it definitely makes for a fun journey. So we take your words of advice to heart here. My guest today has been James Hudnut Boimler. Jim, thanks for being on Research on Religion again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.